or 818-985-5735. And once again, we acknowledge the Armenian Holocaust, the anniversary, tomorrow. So 818-985-5735. Keep your money where it should be. Keep your dollars where they count. 818-985-5735. Call now for Alternative Radio on KPFK. So that way we can keep programs on the air and stay alive to give you more of these programs. Option two. Thank you, David.
Thank you, and thanks to all who have called that number.
This is Public Radio for the Critical Thinker. KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and kpfk.org.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon. This is Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. Good afternoon, Maria.
Good afternoon, Jim Lafferty.
I know it. We're in a fun drive, but as we as our listeners, I think, know by now, we take very little time when we're in a fun drive. We trust them to make the calls during those few little moments when we're pitching on the air, if you will. We have such important topics to get to every week, and this week is no exception, that we try to go right in. So, friends, keep that in mind as we now begin our show. You can call us at any point at 818-985-5735. Choose option two or go to our website. Lots of ways we say thank you. We hope the show and the very fact of this station being on the air is thanks enough, but it's not thanks enough, sadly, to pay our electric bill or to pay our employees who are underpaid as it is. So please do help us out during our spring fun drive. Well, we're going to get started. We've got, as this is one of those, we do it now twice a month, shows where we have Steve Rohde come on, a constitutional scholar, and talk about the latest court action, because there's so much court action going on. In fact, it's fair to say that the Trump administration in its first 100 days has kept the federal court system in the United States very busy, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes, indeed, the Supreme Court, about 1 a.m. last Saturday, the Supreme Court issued an overnight ruling blocking the administration from deporting that group of Venezuelans before they had even had a chance to receive any due process. Meanwhile, yesterday, a federal judge blocked Trump from punishing another law firm, calling the retribution campaign he's waged from the White House against the nation's top law firms a, and I'm quoting, a shocking abuse of power. This has nine of America's largest and most powerful law firms have surrendered to Trump's illegal threats already. They've agreed to provide what amounts to, my goodness, $940 million in free legal services to causes that'll be chosen by, you got it, Donald Trump. And they've agreed to discontinue their efforts at enhancing diversity, equity, and inclusion within their law firms and such. So on the legal front, there's a great deal to cover on this, as I say, one of our twice-monthly shows devoted entirely to Trump's actions and the response of the courts to those actions. And as I say, once again, we're happy to have our go-to expert on these cases with us. Tell us what they're all about, what they mean, what kind of constitutional crisis we may be facing, and that is Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional scholar, as I say. He's a writer, a lecturer, a political activist. He's the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and he's now a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself today, as always. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friend.
Thank you, Jim and Maria. It is truly a pleasure to be with you.
Well, that doesn't necessarily constitute what we're going to have to talk about today, but I too find it a pleasure to be with the two of you at any rate. Steve, let's first concentrate on what the U.S. Supreme Court has been up to vis-a-vis the actions of Trump. And first up is that case ruled upon at about 1 a.m. as best anyone could tell, Saturday. It said that detainees were entitled to be notified if the government intended to deport them under the law, quote unquote, within a reasonable time. And in a way, that would allow that the deportees could challenge the move in court before their removal. So talk to us about that case, and also talk to us about the related case involving the mistaken deportation of Mr. Garcia to El Salvador, the Supreme Court ordering the administration there, remember, to facilitate his return, and the recent ruling by a conservative federal appeals court judge rejecting the Trump administrator's latest appeal in that case. So that's a lot to chew on to get us going.
Thank you, Jim. As we begin, I was thinking about our time together today and all of these important legal principles, the very existence of the rule of law in the United States that so far is curbing much of what Trump is doing. But it struck me, for all of us not to forget, that at the heart of every one of these cases are real people. These are individuals. This is a man like Kilmar Abrego Garcia. They are individuals like Mahmoud Khalil and Renesa Uzturk. They are students. They are permanent residents in many cases. They are workers in all of the business enterprises across America. And they are journalists and lawyers and all the, and they are at bottom us. They are us. And we are fighting for our democracy. And in this show, we focus on how the work of brilliant lawyers and courageous judges are making such a big difference, aligned and standing in solidarity with all the rest of us who are marching, who are organizing in the streets, who are putting in time to appeal to our elected officials to use every possible means at our disposal to fight the destruction of our democracy. We saw a sign of that in, of all places, the United States Supreme Court. And on originally on April 7, they had a case in which involving some of those Venezuelan deportees. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes the Supreme Court buries its lead. That case went off on the notion that the rulings of Judge Boasberg should have been heard in the Texas district for jurisdictional reasons. But in the midst of that decision, they decided that due notice and due process had to be given. And they've just inchingly begun to build on that that doctrine. They have yet to come to grips with the underlying use of the statutes, the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 and the McCarran Act of 1952, laws written in the fever of war and the anticipation of war. But we have to take our victories when they come. And last Saturday, April 19, while many of us were out protesting, they did in the dead of night vote 7-2 that the putative class of detainees, this is a class action, who are seeking an injunction against their removal, must not, they cannot be removed until there is further order of the court. Now that that got a 7-2 vote, and it's a strong ruling on the procedural aspects. But we always know that we've got judges like Judge Justice Alito, and he was joined by Justice Thomas. They only got two of the conservatives to join in this angry dissent that Justice Alito issued. Now, remember that the government is capturing people off the streets at the dead of night, putting them on airplanes in the dead of night, and sitting in his comfortable office in Washington, D.C., Justice Alito complained that shortly after midnight yesterday, the court hastily and prematurely granted unprecedented emergency relief. He's upset that he had to stay up late and work on this case when the rights of hundreds of individuals are at stake. He cited a random set of technicalities, which obviously the 7-member majority didn't find telling. And he ends with words like, literally in the middle of the night, the court issued unprecedented and legally questionable relief without giving the lower courts a chance to rule, without hearing from the opposing party. Within 8 hours of receiving the application, with dubious factual support. And then he has the audacity to end his dissent by saying both the executive and judiciary have an obligation to follow the law. Yeah, the executive has that duty. Now, the problem briefly with Alioto is he was wrong on the facts. He acted as if it was clear that no further planes were taking off last Saturday, like they took off in March. But a careful analysis of the argument before Judge Boasberg, and this has been very well done in the press, especially in Slate, in an article by Mark Joseph Stern, Alito misrepresented what the government said in that case. The government would not give assurances that no further planes were taking off. So he was wrong on the facts. But as you also asked me to touch on, we had really a powerful opinion. Now, this is in the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit by Judge Harvey Wilkinson. Folks can track that down on any search engine. Wilkinson is a Republican, a Ronald Reagan appointee. And in writing his order, and he had the full support of two other Court of Appeals judges, they were seeking to stay the relief granted to Kilmar Abrego Garcia and rushed into that appellate court to seek that relief. And Wilkinson said the relief the government is seeking is both extraordinary and premature. They complimented the lower court judge as a fine district judge, and they cataloged that the government is asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process that is the foundation of our constitutional order. Further, the government claims, in essence, that because it has rid itself of custody, there's nothing it can do. This should be shocking, not only to judges, but to the intuitive sense of liberty that Americans far removed from courthouses still hold dear. The government asserts that Abrego Garcia is a terrorist and a member of the MS-13. Perhaps, perhaps not. Regardless, he is still entitled to due process. I mean, the nation is getting an education in the true nature of what our Constitution protects. And no president gets to label someone a terrorist, label them a gang member, and strip them of their constitutional rights. Every person in this country is entitled to due process, and the courts are speaking up in that regard. I've got some other examples of this in Judge Wilkinson's opinion. I urge people to go and read it. Some of these judges are speaking up. They have a spine, and they are pushing back at the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Thank goodness for that.
Well, Steve Rohde, let's go back for a moment to the underlying case that's in Judge Boasberg's federal courtroom. The fact that the Trump administration is still not returning Venezuelan deportees from El Salvador seems to be moving closer to a contempt hearing. Remind our listeners why this is the case, what it's about, and why contempt charges may be brought.
Yes, and this is why it's so important that we have some time to dwell on these cases, and I encourage people to dig deeper in their own time as well. Judge Boasberg has had to put up with government lawyers in repeated court hearings in which they have obfuscated. I think they have lied to Judge Boasberg. And so finally, he issued a 46-page ruling finding probable cause for criminal contempt. Federal courts do have the power to hold lawyers and parties in both civil and criminal contempt. His case, his decision, cataloged that beginning back on March 15, the court had issued a written TRO barring the government from transferring certain individuals into foreign custody pursuant to the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The court said that rather than comply with the court's order, the government continued the hurried removal operation early on Sunday morning, hours after the court issued its order. The government transferred two plane loads of passengers protected by the TRO into a Salvadoran mega prison. The court found this was a willful disregard of its order, sufficient to conclude that probable cause exists to find the government in criminal contempt. Now, the Supreme Court later vacated that original TRO, and that's because of jurisdiction resting in Texas rather than D.C. But the court made a very important point. For a long time, the Supreme Court has said every judicial order must be obeyed, regardless of later being found erroneous. No man can be the judge in his own case, said the Supreme Court. And John Marshall, our Chief Justice in 1809, said disobeying judicial orders would make, quote, a solemn mockery of the Constitution itself. Trump, his lawyers, his enablers are making that mockery. And this order should have been complied with at the time. They could have sought an appeal, but they could not do what they did. I don't have the time to recount how the lawyers misrepresented the judge. And in one glaring moment, when the lawyer could not answer Judge Boasberg's question, they took a recess. While the recess was being held, two of the airplanes took off after the oral TRO had been granted. This is the kind of abuse. This is why we are in a constitutional crisis. The government is violating court orders. Someday, in some court, that contempt hearing will be held. Those lawyers and the parties who ordered them to do so will be held accountable.
Well, Steve, going now to the college situation, which you made reference to, some of the largest universities and colleges in the country have been, of course, caving in to Trump's efforts. Some of the largest law firms, sadly, have been doing the same thing. You've got a number of the large law firms that have caved. A few are fighting back. Yesterday, in that regard, a federal judge blocked Trump from punishing yet another big law firm, calling what Trump has been doing a shocking abuse of power with respect to these law firms. Indeed, at this point, he's got something like nearly $1 billion worth of free legal services coming because of what some of these law firms have and how they have caved in to his demands. You're about to publish a new article in which you compare how Trump has attacked these law firms with what Hitler did to destroy the rule of law in Germany. Please tell us why you think Trump deserves to be compared to Hitler, at least in this regard.
Yes, you know, a lot of folks throw around analogies and comparisons, but my research indicates that the way that Adolf Hitler went after lawyers, predominantly Jewish lawyers and Jewish judges, is a parallel. It is what Trump is borrowing from the dictator's playbook. There have been attempts to dismantle free societies and authoritarianism by attacking the rule of law and the lawyers who are sworn to uphold it. It's occurred in various countries at various times. But unfortunately, there's an ominous parallel to how Hitler bent a thriving Weimar German legal system before Hitler, and he bent them to his will. And unfortunately, many of those German lawyers were willingly complicit in what Trump is doing, and what Hitler was doing then as well. You see, Trump and Hitler both understand, and they are threatened by lawyers, and they are threatened by an independent legal system. Lawyers, and we've done this so far today and elsewhere, lawyers are an obstacle to what Trump is doing. He's facing 200 lawsuits, over 90 injunctions that are being obtained by lawyers invoking the rule of law. Well, that's exactly what Hitler did. He began systematically dismantling the legal system, barring lawyers. He established the concept that it was the Führer's law. It was the highest law, was the Führer's law, just as Trump wants Trump law to be the highest law. This is a cautionary tale. God forbid we are not down the road to where Nazi Germany was led. But that's what cautionary tales are all about. They're about learning from history and doing everything possible to prevent the worst from happening again.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Pacifica's KPFK 90.7 FM, and you're listening to The Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, and my co-host Jim Lafferty and I are speaking with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde about the legal battles to protect due process and the rule of law in the United States. And as a quick reminder, it's KPFK's fund drive time here. We need every single dollar to keep the airwaves strong. Perhaps this is the most important critical time ever in my lifetime to support KPFK and independent media. Just jump onto kpfk.org and make your pledge. Steve, you call what Trump is doing with the large law firms a cautionary tale. Are we doomed to repeat what happened in Germany, or is there time to change the course of this ship?
Well, as Hitler rose to power, millions of people did not march in the streets. There were some courageous ones who did, but it didn't have the national impact. There were not general strikes, boycotts of Nazi businesses and those that cooperated with the Nazis. Lawyers didn't and weren't able to invoke the rule of law to seek the kinds of injunctions we're talking about. Members of the Reichstag failed to invoke Article 59 of the Weimar Constitution, adopted in 1919, to bring impeachment proceedings before the Supreme Judicial Court to remove the president, chancellor, and ministers who were in willful violation at that time. Today, if we're going to prevent history from repeating itself, defenders of democracy in this country need to protest, have a general strike, have boycotts of the airlines that are flying these planes to El Salvador and Tesla. We need to enjoin, impeach, and remove Trump and his henchmen. But it is going to take that concerted kind of effort if we're not going to repeat the terrible example of Nazi Germany.
You know, it's interesting. This morning I was interviewing Chris Hedges for the show that each of us take turns co-hosting, the national show that we have, Law and Disorder. And by the way, folks, you can go to lawanddisorder.org, and you can where all of our shows are archived. This is a show that Steve and Maria and I and someone else does as well, Michael Smith. And we're at about 156 stations now around the country. So it's a fairly widely broadcast show. And on this morning show, Chris agreed with what you were just saying, but he would add to it that those demonstrations, until they get to the point where they're really more disruptive, when they get to the point where they really pose a certain threat to business as usual, it won't be enough. But he too called for that same kind of general strike and for a workers' movement that you're talking about. Well, continuing on with our show today, a headline, Stephen, Monday's New York Times reads, and I quote, "A legal battle over Trump's threats to public school funding has begun," close quote. And the article explains that there are now lawsuits against the Trump administration's demand, because the Trump administration has demanded that all 50 states end the use of what it says are illegal diversity programs in public schools, or risk losing federal funding for what? Low-income students. Talk to us about this legal quarrel.
Yes, and it's those low-income students that are another example of what I started with at the top of the show, the real people, the real children in this case, who are being harmed. Yes, fortunately, a dozen Democratic-leaning states, including California, New York, and Michigan, they refused to sign an administration directive, which had come from one of Trump's executive orders. Two of the largest teachers' union, along with the NAACP, are challenging those demands in federal court. Trump is relying on a novel interpretation of civil rights law. He's turning it on its head. He's saying that to the extent issues of systemic racism, of American history, of critical race theory, and other parts of comprehensive American history are being taught, that constitutes discrimination, and they cite the one federal Supreme Court case involving, remarkably, Harvard and the University of North Carolina, where the Supreme Court did say that race cannot be taken into consideration in the admissions into those high-level universities. But that's never been held true with regard to K-12 public schools or the whole panoply of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility programs that are meant to try to create a level playing field. As Justin Driver, a professor at Yale Law School and an expert on the Constitution, said, the Trump administration is trying to use a relatively narrow decision and turn it into a broad holding that brings about whatever it wishes. And schools are fighting back because these Title I funds, they're withholding billions of dollars that help to educate low-income students. This is where the rubber is going to hit the road. It's going to hit the road when Social Security checks don't hit your bank account, and when the aisles in our grocery stores are empty of products. In this case, fortunately, with good lawyers fighting back, they are beginning to have an impact, as is the National Education Association and the American Civil Liberties Union in a New Hampshire case, along with a similar one by the American Federation of Teachers. We're going to follow those cases and those results very closely on this show and elsewhere.
Also, another case we might as well discuss at this point, too, because it's an opinion from just yesterday at a local district court. It's a case in which a Reagan-appointed judge ordered Trump to restore the fired staff at the Voice of America, that 80-year-old governmental-funded news service. That, again, is a victory, at least at the low levels of the federal court system. So we'll probably get you to talk about that. But I see now that we've got, what, just maybe 30 seconds or so before our station ID break, which is mandated by the government, even before Trump. So we'll take that brief station ID and be right back with you and give you a chance to answer that and many more cases.
Support comes from the Hammer Museum at UCLA, presenting Alice Coltrane Monument Eternal, now on view through May 4th. Discover the extraordinary life and legacy of jazz legend Alice Coltrane through the work of 19 contemporary artists and rare archival materials. The exhibition is accompanied by a weekly musical performance series in the galleries, special conversations with artists and musicians, tours, and more. Visit hammer.ucla.edu and kpfk.org for more information.
Well, we are right back with you. That was a good short ID break. And because we've got a lot to discover, you're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, the co-host of the show. And as we're now doing twice a month, we have with us as our guest today, Steve Rohde, in order to discuss the, well, heavy court loads of cases where people are either challenging or being challenged by the Trump administration in the courts of law. And we are very fortunate to have Steve Rohde with us. Steve is able to explain these matters. You don't have to be a Philadelphia lawyer, as they say, in order to understand what's being talked about. And it's critically important that our audience understand these cases, because this isn't something just happening off in a courtroom that doesn't affect you. It affects every aspect of American life as Trump seeks to take over governance in the United States and bring it solely under his command. Steve, I had asked you just before the break to talk about the case having to do with the report with the returning of staff to the Voice of America. What can you tell us about that matter?
Yeah, there are no limits to Trump's ravaging of American society. The Voice of America, in existence for 80 years, funded by the U.S. Agency for Global Media, reaching people all over the world. Now, I'll insert a caveat that over time, some of us have had questions about the Voice of America. It's been accused of propagating U.S. propaganda and spreading false information, frankly. But for today, we put that aside and we can debate that. What we can't debate is the dismantling entirely of the Voice of America, which is what Trump is trying to do by a March 14 executive order. You see, he thinks he can just put a term, an accusation that the Voice of America is spreading far left ideology, and by those talismanic words, everyone will fall by the wayside, and opportunity that's existed for 80 years can be dismantled. Well, not so fast, Donald Trump, because yesterday, U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth. Now, I remember the name Royce Lamberth. He was a judge at the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, where he served from 1995 to 2002. And we got to know about that court during the George Bush administration and the secret warrants and the surveillance of American telephones and online services. Well, Royce Lamberth is also a student of the Constitution and a student of law, and he restrained Donald Trump's executive order and the implementation of it. He not only restrained it, he ordered that he restored all of the employees and contractors to the Voice of America news programs, and he unfroze the funds streaming for affiliated networks like Radio Free Asia and the Middle East Broadcasting Networks. He pointed out that what Trump is doing is put overseas correspondents at risk of being deported to their home countries and silencing the voice of America, depriving hundreds of millions of listeners of news and information. Here's just one quote from his strong opinion. It's hard to fathom a more straightforward display of arbitrary and capricious actions than the Trump administration's actions here. Trump was sweeping aside congressional mandates requiring that funding. That has been stopped. I'm sure the Trump administration will rush into court if they're not there today to try to block that injunction. But this is a very strong opinion, and it's an example that the judges that are stepping up on this are not democratically appointed. They are coming as Bush judges and Ronald Reagan judges, as this one was. So no one can undermine what the courts are doing as if it's partisan. It's across the board because it's simply based on the Constitution and the law.
Well, Steve Rohde, let's talk about another case involving the State Department rule prohibiting passports from including a gender different from the sex listed on an original birth certificate. Last Friday, a federal judge ordered the Trump administration to issue passports that reflect the self-identified gender of the transgendered plaintiffs who had brought the challenge. Now, this case will likely be appealed, but do you think it's significant that the lower court ruled as it did?
Oh, I do. This was a very important case because Trump has been crowing about the fact that he issued an executive order mandating by government law that there are only two genders. He followed that up with all kinds of nefarious rulings. Several of those have been cut back on transgender individuals. And here on the gender identity of individuals in their passports, the judge issued a preliminary injunction finding that Trump's executive order and a State Department policy prohibited the updating of sex designations on passports. And the judge found that it was likely unconstitutional and a violation of the law. In that case, they are requiring the State Department to allow six transgender and non-binary people to obtain passports with sex designations consistent with their gender identification. This goes back to his first day in office. I mean, these are the priorities he had in his first day. Trump signed an executive order mandating discrimination against transgender people across the federal government. And it included a directive to the Department of State and Homeland Security to require that government-issued identification documents, including passports, visas, and global entry cards, reflect their sex at conception. Within 48 hours, the State Department began holding passports and other documents back, and they rejected applications. There were over 214,000 public comments in opposition to this State Department new policy. So in February, in the case of Orr versus Trump, filed by the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts and Covington and Burling, by the way, one of the law firms that did not buckle under,
right,
on behalf of those individuals. And now that theory, their legal analysis has been vindicated. It's very important to prevail at the trial level where these judges are looking at the facts and the law in detail. They issue, as they did here, a comprehensive opinion. What may come in the Court of Appeals and in the higher courts remains to be seen. But this is an important step forward in protecting transgender and non-binary people's rights.
Yeah, well, Steve, in his first term, and talk about things that are confusing and why I think it's good to do this show, to have you explaining these things, because in his first term as president, Trump did whatever he could to get rid of Obamacare, that is the Affordable Care Act. He made it clear where he stood on that. But now his administration is defending Obamacare in a case before the Supreme Court. What's happened? Has Trump really come to his senses? I find that hard to believe.
No, don't be fooled, as I know you're not, Jim. Yeah. This is a case, and it's worth taking a moment on it, because eventually it involves Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Yes.
The chaos and mischief that he is causing in his department, really affecting, again, to my top line theme today, affecting the lives and the health of real people. So what happened was the Obamacare has a provision and the ability of millions of Americans to access cost-free preventative services that include cancer screenings, statins for help preventing cardiovascular disease, PrEP drugs that help prevent HIV infections, and counseling referrals for pregnant and postpartum women at increased risk of depression. Now, the government, Congress, under Obamacare, created an entity known as the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which issues recommendations that are supposed to be shielded from political influence. Now, you gotta follow the ball here, the way that this case is being tried, because initially there were challenges to Obamacare brought by some conservatives. The lawsuit was filed at the end of the first Trump administration by a Texas business and other individuals who did not want to offer coverage of these kinds of preventative services, including medication for HIV, because of their religious and moral objections to those treatments. So the lawsuit has been pending throughout the Biden administration. Now, the Trump DOJ picked up that defense because the challengers, the right-wing challengers, had argued that the mandates were unconstitutional because they come from that task force whose membership hasn't been Senate confirmed. Well, the arguments that emerged were that, in fact, The HHS secretary does play a role in deciding which of the preventative service recommendations are ultimately become coverage mandates. So, cutting through it, Trump wants Robert Kennedy Jr. to have expanded power, right, to decide which of these task force recommendations to accept and which to reject. So ironically, his DOJ was put in the position of defending this agency and this aspect of Obamacare. But let's not be fooled. In every single one of these cases, you look behind the superficial facts. He wants the court to uphold this aspect of Obamacare and to use the logic that this task force can be upheld because the HHS secretary, who just happens now to be Robert Kennedy Jr., has discretion to accept or reject the task force's recommendations. And you can only imagine which side of accepting or rejecting Kennedy Jr. will use. So it will be a mixed decision. I'm very interested in how limited the decision is by the conservatives, I mean, by the by the liberals on the court. But that's an important case for us to watch.
Yeah.
Well, here's another one. Professor Aaron Tang at UC Davis Law School had an interesting guest essay in the New York Times last week. In it, he asks whether the conservative legal doctrine known as the major questions doctrine, which is very popular with the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, and which has been used to constrain the reach of regulatory agencies, whether that will be used to challenge Trump's boundless claims of presidential power, quote unquote. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, this is this comes perfectly after our last question, because we really got to watch the ball on what's going on in the United States Supreme Court. So to put this in context, we have the administrative state that has been built up over the years. It emerged, of course, in the New Deal when this large sprawling nation and the economic recovery that was required really needed to have a robust system of administrative agencies with experts that are skilled. They are largely nonpartisan. They serve across administrations in the whole range of issues of clean air and environmental protection and health protection and the like. And largely, the Supreme Court had deferred to these administrative agencies under a case called the Chevron Doctrine. Well, increasingly, this new conservative majority has been chipping away at those administrative agencies, probably because what they mostly do is regulate commerce and businesses, and the Republican platform demands less regulation and less oversight. And so the court literally cooked up the major political question doctrine. It doesn't exist in the U.S. Constitution. It doesn't exist in any statute. It's a judge-made doctrine that says if the question before an administrative agency involves a major question, then the court has greater leeway to overturn those administrative agencies, often at the behest of corporations that are the polluters and the despoilers of our environment. And since the Supreme Court can't say that it's in favor of pollution, they came up with a, quote, doctrine of the major questions doctrine, saying that, boy, when this is a major question, then we cannot defer to these administrative agencies. Instead, nine judges are going to decide what's right or wrong when it comes to clean air and clean water. Ironically, now, it is this major questions doctrine that is being used in many of the lawsuits you and I have been discussing in order to question, for example, whether Elon Musk and Doge is allowed to run rampant through congressional authority, when in fact it obviously raises a major economic, political, and social question which should prevent Elon Musk and Doge from rampaging through those policies. Once again, a conservative group, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, is trying to use this doctrine against the tariffs in favor of businesses that are waking up to the fact that tariffs are harming their businesses. So in that respect, it could well be the hook that is the death knell for many of Trump's tariffs, because he has usurped the power of Congress. He has usurped these administrative agencies, and it may well be used on questions of freezing federal funding. It could even be used on the question of revoking birthright citizenship, interfering with elections and other issues, because these are all major questions. Now, again, as these doctrines flip-flop, it may eventually and will eventually come to the U.S. Supreme Court. They've been very good when it serves their purposes to invoke originalism when they want to, but not invoke it when they want to give Trump criminal immunity, and they sweep aside any originalism because criminal immunity nowhere appears in the U.S. Constitution. So that conservative majority is adept at doing this. I think one of the purposes of our conversations every few weeks is to keep the American people alert, to have them have a sense even of these rather technical legal doctrines of what's at stake in these cases. I feel that an American people armed with knowledge of these legal doctrines, as clear and as plain as we try to make them on this program, it's part of being an educated populace. Exactly. It's part of understanding what Trump is trying to do when he attacks the rule of law.
And we have a question or two that we would like to have gotten to. We'll get to it in the next session we do this. But I'm mindful of the clock, and I'm mindful of the fact that if we ought to be able to continue doing what we're doing, and if the other shows on KPFK want to continue doing what they're doing, then you, our listeners, have to help us do that. You know what's going on. They want to cut funding for social and government programming all over. Public radio is in dire straits. We're all in dire straits when it comes to that. We get precious little money from the federal government anyway. The only way that we're able to sustain ourselves and bring you this kind of programming week after week here on KPFK is because of you. I mean, there's just no secret about that. I mean, we don't say that just to make you feel good. In fact, you'd probably feel better if the government gave us so much money that we didn't have to bother you. But that's far, far from the situation. We have to bother you, if you will, because without you, we just don't exist. That's no joke. We have no money in the bank. We don't operate that way. Our bills come in every month, and every month we have to pay them. And all of radio stations these days are just able to keep their heads above water. So if you want us to keep above water, if you want us to continue bringing you the kind of programming that we bring you week after week, then, my friends, you have to pick up the phone. And if you pick up the phone, it's easy. You call us at 818-985-5735. Choose option two. And when you do that, one of our volunteers will take your information, your credit card, or however you want to pay for this, and let you pick whatever gift you've decided to pick as our way of saying thank you. And in that regard, that you can do that directly through our web. Talk to us about that a little bit, Maria, and what are some of the ways we're saying thank you this week?
Sure. Well, yeah, I always give every fun drive. We are volunteers here, by the way, so please do help us with that. We put in our blood, sweat, and tears. The thank you gift that I chose this time was I had heard about it on Rhapsody in Black, the show on Saturdays, and it is a 2-CD set of the Ink Spots. We're doing a whole show about it. You can still go on the archives and listen April 19th, Rhapsody in Black. And the Ink Spots, if you don't know, it's the most beautiful romantic melodies and harmonies from the 1930s and 40s. And it really just transports you to a different mental space and physical space. I don't know. It's crooning. It's just so, so romantic. And just lovely.
I miss that. I want to get that one.
It's great.
I'm going to pledge to get that too. What's that pledge for?
It's a minimum donation of $80.
Oh my goodness.
And it predates the R&B, rock and roll, and doo-wop, but it's kind of the beginning of those. It's really lovely.
That's a bargain.
And then if you want to go something, there's another one that's also $80. Which is, if you don't want to be so subtly romantic, we have also, as a thank you gift, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On live 2-CD set. That's also for $80. So then there's other great music available. Of course, we want you to be able to give and want to give even $1, $5, whatever it may be. Every bit counts. Sometimes we can give a little more. Sometimes we can't give at all. But it's really on all of us to support.
Yes, it is. And I make the point whenever we're doing this. And again, Don't just because we take so few minutes to do this every time now, as opposed to what we used to take 20 minutes of every hour. Don't think that's because we've suddenly discovered a gold mine and a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow or something. No, no, nothing could be further from the truth. We've only changed our methods because we know what a critical time in America this is. And so we feel a morally constrained to cut down the amount of time we ask for your funds. We would hope that you would feel morally inspired because of that to contribute just as much and just as often as you have in the past, keep renewing your membership or whatever. You can become a full-fledged member for $25. But we hope that those of you that are employed and doing well might decide to donate $1,000, $500, $250, $25 a month, whatever, because it is such a critical time in our history. And when we do that, we've made this point before too, it's only here on this show and shows like it on KPFK that movement leaders from the progressive movements in LA, the organizers that are organizing the protests, that are organizing the meetings, that are challenging various aspects of government which are wrong-footed, that you hear them. We're the voice of the progressive movement in LA. That's what KPFK is. And so think about when you make that contribution, you're really contributing to that whole progressive cause and those progressive movements defending civil rights, civil liberties, and such here in LA. What are some of the other ways that people, we say thank you, by the way?
Well, actually, I think Steve...
Oh, wait, hold on a second. I'm sorry, Steve, you had your hand up. You wanted to throw in...
Well, I want to chime in because I literally put my money where my mouth is.
There you go.
I come on this show. I exercise my right of free speech at your invitation. But I became a donor, and at my level, I got a copy of I.F. Stone's book, The Trial of Socrates. I.F. Stone was a towering figure in independent journalism, muckraking. Anyone who's heard his name or should study the works of I.F. Stone. And here he went deeply back to look at one of the earliest persecutions of a thinker in The Trial of Socrates. It's an extraordinary book, and it is a premium at KPFK.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I actually read that as part of a class assignment in undergraduate school in my philosophy class back in 19, whatever it was. And I'd like to get that myself.
Well, Jim,
yes.
I thought you were on Socrates' defense team.
I was part of the defense, but you know how the mind
older,
you kind of forget stuff. I can't remember all of my arguments then, but I remember some of Socrates, and I'd like to go back and read that. But really, we've got just a couple of minutes left before we start hearing that theme music, friends. So do give us a call, 818-985-5735. Let us know you care about this kind of radio, unique radio, alternative radio, radio you just don't hear from the corporate media. They have a different interest in mind, and it isn't the same one we have. We just try to take care of and bring information to those who need it, who are often the least advantaged in our society, and who benefit from the kind of programming that we do, because the kinds of programs that are for them, we announce on this show, we interview the people from those programs on this show, we bring that message to you. So give us a call at 818-985-5735, and or go to the website. That's an easy, leisurely way to do it. You can find many. I wasn't aware of the couple of premiums that our guest Steve Rohde and my co-host Maria Hall had taken. I'm now going to take advantage of one or two of those myself, and you can do the same. So do that. That's your way of saying, we hear the music playing. And so that's all we can say for now. We'll be back with you next week, the same time, the Lawyers Guild Show. On behalf of our show today, Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall, we thank you so much for listening. We will be back with you next week. Until then, my friends, besides calling us, you make sure you stand up for your rights and stay active.
Stand up for your rights. Get up.
Let me tell you a story. On June 23rd, 1967, the LAPD beat anti-war demonstrators bloody. Only one radio station in the Southland covered the beatings, KPFK. And that was the day a young kid in Pacoima broke open his piggy bank and joined KPFK.
This is Greg Palast. I was that kid, and for 55 years, I've been a member of KPFK and Pacifica stations. Why? Because the courageous reporting continues. And when other media covers up the news, KPFK uncovers it. Won't you join me? This is Greg Palast asking you to go to kpfk.org. And if you got one of those telephone things, 818-985-5785. 985-5735-818-985-KPFK.